ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming. It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Bjørn Jonsson, who's an emeritus professor from the Department of Clinical Physiology at the University of Lund in Sweden. Bjorn will be known to many of us here and to generations of respiratory physiologists and respiratory physicians and intensivists. I think it's fair to say that whilst probably the preeminent centre in post-war respiratory physiology might have been in the United States, in Rochester with Rahn and Otis and Fenn, and then perhaps in UCSD, with West and Wagner. I think it's fair to say that the European centre during this time and beyond, particularly at the clinical end of respiratory physiology, has been in and around the University of Lund and Uppsala and also in Copenhagen. So they very much cut their way in the post-war years and since. Many of us will know Bjorn's scientific work, but many of us will unwittingly know Bjorn's other major work, which is as the inventor of the Servo 900 series of ventilator, which really paved the way for modern ITU ventilatory care. I won't steal too much more of your speech, Bjorn, so I'll be very much looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your introduction, and thank you for the invitation to come to Oxford for the first time in my life. And in the early days, in the 60s, I visited the United Kingdom very, very frequently, and I got part of my education as concerns how to speak and how to present the slides and so on, and you met a lot of criticism in United Kingdom, but it was always constructive criticism, and which I needed badly in these days. I hope I have improved a little bit since then. So, I started my work in the Department of Clinical Physiology in 1960. I was sent by my boss, Håkan Westling, to Sven Ingelstedt at the ENT department. He was assistant professor in ENT. And he was a fabulous man, a great teacher, a genius in research, and an odd fellow. He had a pamphlet on his bookshelf, reading on the back, God and I Know. So I asked him, why are we not free? And one day he put this pamphlet on my desk, and I read. I did not understand anything but these words: ventilators are pressure or volume controlled. This is silly. They should be flow controlled. Why? Well, then one could do whatever needed. Postscriptum: one cannot control flow rate. And I was taken by this because I had seen these dreadful ventilators around. And I said, if I learn how to control flow, can't we build a ventilator? And he said, okay, but you will have difficulties. I had some difficulties, but I learned to turn and mill in metal and plastic, and I had to learn to drill and grind in glass, and I constructed a workable flow controller. I applied for a patent on it, and I got it, and I constructed a ventilator together with an engineer. And I applied for a patent, and the day after the application was sent in, I visited Stockholm, and within a week we had an agreement with Siemens Lima that they should make a ventilator, and they put everything in front of us, allowing us to do the work. And in these days, there was no digital, everything was analog. But in 1970, you had the first servo ventilators working in the clinic, and in 1971 it was marketed. And Ashborg had presented a couple of years earlier the seminal paper, Acute Respiratory Distress in Adults. And they propagated for the positive and positive expiratory pressure. So together with the servo, we had from the beginning a PEEP valve, the first PEEP valve on the market. I was a physiologist, and I said, we must do measurements. And the servo itself had, of course, flow meters and pressure meters of excellent quality, and we constructed a flow line mechanics calculator in 1975, I think, and which presented resistance and compliance and end expiratory lung pressure, which is auto-PEEP, which was presented by the Americans several years later without measuring what already existed on the market. Well, then I was also part of the construction of the volumetric capnograph, the first one ever made. And then we could monitor flow rate, pressure, and CO2, which are still the classical signals which you need for your patient care, as I will show you. In 1975, I was in Rotterdam, and using this capnogram, a prototype of the capnograph, and we recorded the single breath test for CO2, with fraction of CO2 on the y-axis against expired tidal volume on the x-axis. And here you see what happened when you shield an infant before surgery. We'll come back to that. You mentioned the Giants, some Giants. Ron, West, I would also mention, they were my close friends, and so was Jeremy. We sailed together. And he explained that if you re-expand a collapsed lung, the pressure which you apply will be multiplied because of shear forces in the lungs. And this drawing I made in 1982, and I explained that the respiratory pattern should open up closed units of the lung and maintain aeration and stability throughout the respiratory cycle. This still holds, as we come back to. I will talk about surfactant and give facets of surfactant function and surfactant dysfunction. In a paper, we described how surfactant dysfunction makes lung vulnerable to repetitive collapse and re-expansion. I will use this word, repetitive collapse and re-expansion, a lot. I call it recorex. So rabbits were exposed to a surfactant deoctyl sulfur succinate inhaled in aerosol, which disturbs surfactant. And if you give 0, 2, and 5% surfactant dose to rabbits, nothing happens with mechanics, nothing happens with gas exchange. But then we subjected the other group of rabbits to negative end expiratory pressure. And we observed the lungs. We made a thoracotomy, so we could see the lungs were really collapsing breath by breath. And during the knee period, which lasted 3 hours, 7,200 cycles of collapse re-expansion, we observed that the rabbits who did not receive any deoxyl sulfur succinate, they recovered completely after 3 hours. And if they had a 2% dose in this aerosol, they partly recovered, and with 5% dose, compliance did not return. So was the blood gases, and we also, of course, made, after death, we made microscopy of the lungs, and those who had been subjected to NEEP for 3 hours, pretty normal alveoli. So, surfactant protects the lung. So not every lung which is collapsed and re-expanded will have ventilator-induced lung injury. Another aspect of surfactant, which is now well known but not discussed in conjunction with ARDS, is that surfactant is the main function that maintains the alveolo-capillary barrier against exchange of water-soluble substances between blood and alveolar fluid. So if you have charged the lung with DTPA, technetium marked DTPA, there's a solvable substance, it clears very slowly from the lung, and then you just give a few breaths of DOS, deoxyl sulfur succinate, which perturbs surfactant, and immediately the DOS, the DTPA, disappears from the lungs in a very fast. So we have opened up the barrier between the alveolar and the capillaries. And we have showed that in a series of studies that this is true for small particles like DTPA, but also true for albumin, for example. You learn in textbooks that surfactant gives a hysteresis to the lung. And they often refer to the papers of Mead in the 60s and 70s. But they did not read the Mead papers carefully enough. We made a study where we studied rabbits, and we had a body plethysmographic technique which was very, very, very carefully arranged. And we ventilated the lungs and measured the static pressure volume curve, volume, elastic pressure, using small tidal volumes, and open circles are inspiration, closed circles, closed dots are expiration, no hysteresis. Increased the tidal volume, exactly the same thing, and then we applied very large tidal volumes, and no hysteresis. Hysteresis only appears if you lower the volume below functional residual capacity so that the lungs is collapsed. And when you reopen the lung, then there will be hysteresis. Then you will deposit a lot of energy, destructive energy, in the lungs, as we will come back to. That is very important for physiology of ARDS. So here is a lung from a patient with ARDS, recorded in Paris, where I have been working a lot with Laurent Bouchard, and we see that the lung has a large hysteresis, and that the hysteresis, if you start from a PEEP, the hysteresis is decreased, but still there is a significant hysteresis in these patients with severe ARDS, and I will show you that this is due to collapse and reopening, and we have made a lot of studies in this field. So, now we go to the damaged lung. There is a sort of lung injury. And that very frequently leads to capillary alveolar leakage. And the leakage, the exudate, will be proteinaceous, which means it contains albumin and also to some degree fibrinogen. And these substances, these proteins, are very, very powerful surfactant inactivators. So they inactivate surfactant, and when surfactant is inactivated, the surface forces will lead to lung collapse during expirations. Recorex will open up the lungs during inspirations, and that leads to lung injury according to the Mead and lots of studies which we have performed, and lots of other people have shown that this is very destructive. It's the main injurious phenomenon, Recorex, also called atelect trauma. And injury leads to capillary alveolar leakage. And this leads to a vicious circle, a maelstrom, which rapidly leads to lung destruction. If you come into this stage, it goes very, very fast. If you have, for example, a viral pneumonia, which I fear will come to us within soon, when the damage has reached a certain level, within hours, I would say within minutes, the lung injury may get worse, by the minute. Well, this is not the only cause. There will be inflammation, and inflammation will release a lot of substances leading to biotrauma. And the biotrauma will hurt other organs, the kidneys, the heart, the brain, the liver, and everywhere. You have a patient with multi-organ failure that has been starting in the lung. But inflammation in the body can also go the other ways and set up this vicious circle in the lung. So this is a bidirectional phenomenon. And that, these maelstroms in the lung and in the body, that's what most often leads to the death of the patient. So what is your task? You must stop this series of events. You must stop Recorex. Not only limit it, you must really halt it. And I would say it is possible to do so, as we come to. We go to the pressure volume curve of a dog with very famous people here who studied the elastic pressure volume curve, inspiratory pressure volume curves, and here you see a very steep segment, and that has been used to say that there is a high compliance, that's good, so let's ventilate the lung over this segment. But if you see what happens indeed, you start with a collapsed lung in this oleic acid. You increase PEEP, you get some aeration, you go further and further, and you have to go up to very high pressures to completely recruit the lung. Pressures so high that they are certainly deleterious and will cause barotrauma. So the steep part of the lung represents the most dangerous zone, which you must avoid. You should never ventilate the patient over such a segment where there is Recorex every breath. That's destructive. At the same time, as former paper was published, Crotty and others presented some measurements of opening and closing pressures in patients with ARDS. Only 5 patients, but very, very carefully performed study. And they studied the opening pressures in, and that was just like in the dogs with oleic acid. The opening pressures had a wide distribution. It was a normalized distribution, and you see very high pressures was needed indeed to open up the lungs of these patients. And then they studied the closing pressure. They went the other way around, and they found that the closing pressure were much lower. And that is the reason why there is a hysteresis of the pressure volume curve. It's just another aspect of that. And what is very important is that the difference, this difference, is the key for lung protective ventilation. And the difference between the closing pressures are very, very roughly, say 15 centimeters of water lower than the opening pressures. And now I will propose, as many others do now, do never recruit the lung completely. Don't even try it. Because part of the lungs, if you try to open up the lung, you will have barotrauma and you can't maintain it anyway, so the lung will recollapse. So just leave part of the lung in the collapsed state. Never use higher inspiratory plateau pressure than about 30 centimeters of water. There could be some if you have a very high abdominal pressure, you could go, you are forced to go a bit higher, but beware, high plateau pressures are deleterious. So say, stay below 30 in plateau pressure. If you now reduce the pressure by propose 12 centimeters of water, then the lung units which are open will not close. Because there is a difference, they will close at a pressure which on average is 15 centimeters of water lower than when they open. So if you remain safely below 15 centimeters of water or pressure difference between plateau pressure and expiratory pressure, you could, in most cases, very drastically reduce recorex, or, which I hope, stop it. And that is the delta P issue, which is promoted by Amato and others. And they published, I want to refer to the paper Driving Pressure and Survival in ARDS by Amato and others in New England Journal of Medicine. So, I said that there is a possibility to avoid recorrex and at the same time to avoid barotrauma, the two deleterious factors. But you have to ventilate the lung. And ventilation is for CO2 exchange, not for oxygenation, because oxygenation you can just by keeping the lung open and have a proper FiO2, you have a sufficient oxygenation. Patients seldom do of hypoxia. But you must ventilate the lung so that you can maintain a target PaCO2. And your first duty when you ventilate the patient is say, I ventilate the patient. And the reason why I ventilate the patient is that I should reach a target PaCO2. I don't want to start a debate about what is target. I, as a physiologist, I say something like 40, maybe 50. If there is no other reason for acidosis, you can have a slight respiratory acidosis. I say slight. So what is PCO2 depending upon? It is depending upon the metabolic rate, the CO2 production. CO2 is produced in the tissues and it's eliminated by ventilation. And this is this very simple equation describing what determines alveolar PCO2. It's the quotient between CO2 production metabolic rate and alveolar ventilation times the barometric pressure. Simple physics. So you can transform that equation so that you can describe the tidal volume which you need to keep a certain PCO2. It depends on metabolic rate. It's more or less proportional to metabolic rate. Of course, you can increase respiratory rate, But there are two things which I want to point you, stress, which you start with. You should be aware of that metabolic rate varies dramatically in patients. You can have two similar patients in two beds of IRS. One produces 250 millimeters or 200 millimeters of CO2 per minute, and the other 500, two, three times more. Why? We know so little about it. There have been no studies about, although I produced these machineries, the CO2 volumetric capnographer, reading the CO2 elimination rate every breath by breath. Very little science, nearly none, has been done. But we know it from experience. I have seen hundreds of patients where there is this. Of course, fever, anxiety, pain are reasons for high metabolic rates. And you should be aware of that. And there is one more factor which is even more dramatic, and that is respiratory efforts, muscle work. Look at a patient in panic, fighting for its life. What do you think about his metabolic rate? Be very careful about non-invasive ventilation when this happens. So metabolic rate. I believe that inflammation is one of the reasons for this huge difference. It's not only pain, fever, and anxiety. It's probably inflammation, but we don't know. There are no studies. So metabolic rate should be considered. And then the other big factor is the physiological dead space. I talked about metabolic rate. And the paper about Papazian, he showed, it's one of the few papers who showed an improvement of with respect to mortality. And that was when he applied neuromuscular blockers in early respiratory distress syndrome. And this is, I believe, I don't know, but I believe this is not practiced to the extent that it's worthwhile. That is worth. So, to minimize tidal volume, you have now attacked the metabolic rate. The physiological dead space is another extremely important factor. And lots of studies, the one by me and Beidong in 2002, and same year the famous paper of Nocton, showing that physiological dead space is one of the most important predictive factors, prognostic factors in ARDS. Physiological dead space is, now we have the single breath test for CO2, is the area above the single breath test divided by the square or rectangular area limited by the arterial PCO2 and tidal volume. So this area is physiological dead space, and it's huge in ARDS. In this patient, with 74%, has very poor prognosis because it is very, very difficult to ventilate that lung without Recorex and further destruction. So you must reflect, how do I reduce airway dead space? Use active humidifiers. No humidity and moisture exchanger. That will reduce. In the old days it was about 100 milliliters, now I think they have cranked it down to about 60 milliliters. But 60 milliliters is 1 milliliter per kilogram body weight. It has a large importance. The anaconda has been proposed to sedate patients under these circumstances, but we have shown, together with Sturluson, a young doctor in Lund, that if you use these reflecting filters which reflect, for example, sevoflurane, they also reflect CO2. They take up CO2 during expiration and re-deliver it to the lung during inspiration. So that's no good choice if you have the ARDS patient. gas exchange in the lung occurs by bulk flow down to the respiratory zone. And within the respiratory zone, the bulk flow is so slow, so the diffusion is much faster in the very periphery of the lung. Very old knowledge since the early 60s. And diffusion is a time that takes time. It's a time-limited process. And we have studied how the time, for how long time the inspired gas remains in the alveoli during the respiratory cycle. We call it the mean distribution time, and I don't go into the mathematical detail how it's calculated, but during the post-inspiratory pause, all the gas has been delivered, all the gas is in the alveolar zone, and the pause is, even without mathematics, you can realize that the pause is very important for the mean distribution time. So, this is a study made in Paris, again with Laurent Bouchard and his group. We just changed the ventilation pattern. We changed it using the Servo 900C, and it was controlled by a computer, so you could change everything. But in these cases, we just changed it in the inspiratory pause. And if you prolong the inspiratory pause, you observe that the CO2 appears earlier during expiration, which means that CO2 has penetrated further up into the airways. But you also see that the alveolar plateau was higher. So this means that a long post-inspiratory pause decreases airway dead space, but also, to our surprise, alveolar dead space. When we were not surprised when we had considered the physics about it. It was rather evident that it should be that way. So, just by turning the knob, inspiratory pause time, one can increase CO2 elimination by 10 to 15%. This is rarely used in the clinic, I believe. We have written a dozen of papers about it, and it does not penetrate. I don't know why. Well, another cause of alveolar dead space is the shunt. And the shunt is very well known because it reduces the oxygenation, arterial oxygenation. But it also, the shunted blood also carries CO2, which should have been eliminated by ventilation. So the shunt leads to a rising alveolar arterial blood PCO2 and increases the area here which corresponds to alveolar dead space. This had never been quantified mathematically and physically, and in an enormous simulation process, computer simulation process, we simulated this using Haldane's equations, Bohr equations, every kind of equations. It was with iterative mathematics, and we could observe the following. Here we have on the y-axis how large portion of the alveolar ventilation which was dead space because of the shunt. So the alveolar dead space fraction caused by shunt. If the physiology was normal from every other aspect, we can follow the red line here and show that if you have a 40% shunt, which is sort of common in ARDS, 10% of the alveolar ventilation will be lost as dead space. You need to increase the ventilation by alveolar ventilator by 10% in order to overcome the effect of shunt. If you now have a low hemoglobin concentration, that made it a little bit worse. If the patient now, say, is hypovolemic and has a reduced cardiac output, it becomes much more important. And now this patient is hypoxic, has a poor cardiac output. He starts to produce lactate and gets a metabolic acidosis on the top of it. And that makes things really bad. 20% of the alveolar ventilation is now lost for as a dead space. Now you observe there's some acidosis in this patient, and you say, I crank up ventilation in order to control ventilation, in order to control pH. But that is a bad idea, because that will increase the effect of shunt very dramatically. So never use hyperventilation in order to correct for. And of course, to hyperventilate your patient with increased tidal volume will make it difficult to avoid recorrects. There are lots of reasons. This is one reason, one additional reason not to use that strategy. So what can you do then? You keep the lung open, and that will bring you back to a lesser shunt fraction. Of course, that will also reduce the dead space. Then you should maintain homeostasis. I'm pretty sure that you do that every day. You check for hemoglobin, and you try to maintain cardiac output, etc., and you try to avoid metabolic acidosis as far as possible, and you don't hyperventilate the patient. So good clinical care helps you. Keep the lung open and give the patient good clinical care, and that you, then you have done as much as you can. Still, alveolar dead space is a big problem. So, now we have discussed that you have a target PaCO2, you have done what you can about metabolic rate, and you have done what you can about physiological dead space. Now you must find the relationship between tidal volume and respiratory rate that maintains your target PaCO2. The ARDS network, in their very, very famous study, they proposed to maintain oxygenation, a PEEP FiO2 table, and I don't want to go into that. But they also say that in order to maintain PaCO2 as the target value, and they proposed 40 centimeters or 40 millimeters of mercury, you should adjust the respiratory rate to the needs. You should give a fixed tidal volume, 6 times predicted body weight, and then you... And this is not a bad idea. But what they proved was that 6 milliliter per kilogram predicted tidal volume is a better tidal volume than 12. Nothing else. Good enough from many aspects, but it does not say that 6 is some sort of ideal. Sometimes, and if you look at the results, the global results, the mortality rates, since this study was published in 2000, it has not moved significantly. It's about the same. Most studies show a mortality rate of about 40% still. So this is not the ultimate solution to the problem. So there have been dozens, maybe 100 studies of different sorts of titration. PEEP titration, tidal volume titration, respiratory rate titration, I don't know what. And what I say is there is no ideal PEEP, there is no ideal tidal volume, there is no ideal respiratory rate. There is a combination of all settings together which should approach the ideal ventilation. So I already mentioned the flaw of the inspiratory pressure volume curve, that the steepest part of the here is a good place to ventilate the patient, and you don't do that, I'm sure. But now, since then, there has been the story of open lung concept with decremental PEEP titration. So you lower PEEP, you use a very high PEEP, and you lower it and lower it and lower it and lower it, you go down to zero even, and then you find a portion the PEEP value which gives you the highest expiratory, the highest compliance. But the expiratory pressure volume curve is subjected to the same flaw, maybe to a little bit less extent than inspiratory, but during expiration, at the moment the lung unit collapses, it pushes out the gas, and that will lead to a high compliance. So even the expiratory pressure volume curve is does not tell you that this lung should be ventilated at this volume. And then there are prolonged periods of low PEEP, and as I said to you, lung damage occurs within minutes, and if you do it, if you have a traumatic ventilation, it's a very fast, this maelstrom is very fast phenomenon, and it has now been shown in several studies. There is a meta-analysis in the Journal of Intensive Care, 2018, telling you that decremental PEEP titration and lung recruitment process behind that is not useful, rather the opposite. It is associated with increased mortality. Then some very famous people are nowadays discussing that the power which you apply to the lung is destructive. And I agree completely. If you have a small bomb, the destruction will be limited compared to the atomic or bomb binding. So the amount of energy which you apply to a structure will decide about the destructive forces. And they present this equation, an equation I am very much against. They say that airway resistance is an important parameter. But where is airway resistance? You have learned in your textbooks that airway resistance is in the tracheal tube, most of it. And then nearly everything else is in trachea and in the larger bronchi. And in the periphery of the lungs, where the damage occurs, there is nearly nil. Not of course, not nil. But resistance is extremely low. I can also address the problem of the elastance. The elastance I have talked to you about, that the open lung has no hysteresis. It's only when the lung collapses and reopens that you have a hysteresis. And the hysteresis, the surface of the hysteresis is equal to the energy which is lost in the peripheral tissue. And that is why the Recorex, it creates hysteresis, it delivers energy, power, destructive power to the lung. So, in the periphery of the lung tissues, the only destructive force you have is work or power caused by reopening, and also during the collapse there are forces, power, which are destructive. So all this, we must address the problem using the relationship between tidal volume and respiratory rate to reach our target PaCO2. And the Sigler-Best test for CO2 provides the instrument you need. You transform that curve, this is the Kreskel curve, by integration you calculate the volume of CO2, the volume of CO2 expired at any tidal volume. At any tidal volume here, like 300, you can calculate the CO2, or you can measure, or rather, the volume of CO2 expired. And then you can construct the red curve here, which is the relationship between tidal volume and respiratory rate that gives you the proper PaCO2. Not exactly, because what you have learned about the mean distribution time, when you go to a higher respiratory rate, you must increase ventilation a little bit because you increase the dead space fraction because the MDT is changed. So you have to ventilate at a little bit higher rate at a certain tidal volume, must increase the rate a bit further. But we know from our studies, this is the same for dog, for pig lungs, human lungs, healthy or ARDS, is about the same equation. Same physics apply down here. So we know and can compensate for that. This means that for you can ask the computer. The patient has a PCO2, an actual PCO2 current value, of PCACO2 of 58, say. This is an example from a real patient. And my goal is 54. I want to decrease it a little bit, so I have a target. PPLAT was 35. I know that is a bit too high, and this was very severely, so I will still accept 30. I don't go below that. Respiratory rate, I don't know about so much about very, very high respiratory rate, so I say it should not be higher than 50. And the tidal volume should be less than 6 milliliters per kilogram predicted body weight. Then the computer can use the volumetric capnogram to calculate. And if, for example, he can find different settings here, all at the same plateau pressure, lower and lower tidal volumes because higher and higher rates. If you look at the rate of 48, the computer tells you that you can use a tidal volume which is as low as 5.2 rather than 7.1 to start with, and you can decrease the plateau pressure 14. 14 is not hilarious. I would love to see a lower value, but I'm not sure. Then I must sacrifice the PCO2. This is quite possible, and I have a patent for that. I have two patents for that. One with iterative mathematics and one with standard traditional analytic mathematics, and nobody wants to do it. I have approached the industry, all these big industries. But does it work? Of course they must ask, does it work? We showed in the pig study that it really works. We had pigs, and we look at the pressure volume curves. These are expiratory pressure volume curves before ARDS was instituted and after the red curve here. And that was the group in which we applied this protective lung strategy with computer assisted. And we compare that to an ARDS network group. They had the same deterioration after the institution of ARDS. But in the computer-aided lung protective ventilation group, the curves improved for every 4 hours. A long experiment, 24 hours, very tough. And in the ARDS network, it got worse and worse and worse. And so was the oxygenation, and so was the microscopic examination of the lungs after the animals were sacrificed. So, I have tried to give some insights in physics and physiology of ARDS, some cornerstones for lung protective ventilations. The maelstroms driven by surfactant deficiency and inflammations is the real problem. That's where the problem starts and where it ends. The primary goal of ventilation is to achieve PCO2, the target PCO2. Lung protective ventilation, LPV, you must limit PPLAT to stop barotrauma. You must minimize tidal volume and thereby minimize delta volume to stop recurrex. The target is no recurrex. And this means that you must have a PPLAT lower than 15 centimeters of water to have a chance to do that. You reduce metabolic rate and dead space as far as you can. Apply the lowest possible DT at high respiratory rates, and you don't have the computer instrument in your hands, but you can do that in the traditional way by going stepwise. But if you do that, if you start too late with that, lung destruction has progressed so far so that you will not be able to save the patients. Be proactive. Then, when you have reached this, you adjust PEEP until you reach the target PPLAT. You just crank up PEEP until you have the PPLAT is 30. Then the lung is open, you have oxygenation, and then at the end, of course, you adjust FiO2 in order to have a proper oxygenation. And don't overdo that. Because that will show, Hedenstein I call, and also we in Paris, I worked a lot in Paris, have shown that if you have too much oxygen, that will increase lung collapse by denitrogenization. Difficult English word. So, thank you very much for your attention.
We do have a little time for questions. If there are any questions, otherwise I can start first. Yes.
What do you think is the basis for limiting the carbon dioxide to, say, 50 millimeters of mercury? Do you think that's been established in randomized trials for target value of CO2?
Yeah. And so the biology of CO2. CO2 in itself is harmless, merely harmless. It's pH, and nearly every biological basic mechanism, like the cellular membranes, like the contraction of the heart muscle and other muscles, and the effect of the pharmacological effects of adrenergic drugs, acidosis, and for that matter alkalosis, stops all these basic physiological phenomena. Protection against infection, to fight infections. So every basic cellular mechanism is pH dependent. And which means that you must be able to control pH. And that's why you have to use reach PaCO2 in order not to have respiratory acidosis, and for that matter not respiratory alkalosis as well. In ARDS we very rarely end up with, we are so careful not to hyperventilate, so alkalosis is not a problem in our patients. But, if that should be 50 or 40 or millimeter of mercury, or do you use kilopascals or that?
Yeah.
You have Kim Pascal. Well, I was influenced. I was with two American here. We always use kilopascals. 7, 8. And if there is no metabolic acidosis, you can go a bit higher. But the pH, from biological aspects, any pH below 7.3 is deleterious, I'm sure. And that's just plain physiology.
In the order of hands appearance, if you don't mind, Peter.
Can I just ask you a little bit more about what you see as the sort of micro-mechanic sort of aspects of collapse? Because you could imagine an airway collapsing with a significant volume behind it, in which case the volume is trapped, or you could imagine a sort of catastrophic collapsing of actually alveoli down and doing that. What do you think is going on? Do you think
you touch upon a very difficult questions, but in neonatology we know a little bit more of that, and that is because of the group of Robertson in Stockholm has studied what happens in the collapsed lung. Is it, do the airways collapse, or is it through alveolar collapse? And now by surface microscopy we have shown that there is a lot of alveolar collapse, but I'm also sure that there is a lot of small airway collapse. And when you recruit, re-expand, I hate the word recruit, but what does recruit mean? Recruit for me means that you open up the lung and keep it open, then it's, the lung is recruiting. But if it collapses and it's re-expanding every breath, that's why I don't call that recruitment, because that is a recruitment for half a breath.
I can see that one of those would be very much more damaging than the other. That collapse of the alveoli, one can see it must also impinge upon, because of the localized volume loss, you're expanding elsewhere.
In the neonatologicals, where we have the best studies, it shows you that it's the very small airways which are first harmed. The initial harm is caused within the respiratory zone, in the very smallest airways. The epithelium is disrupted, and there is leakage started, and from there you have the proteins leaking into the alveoli, and from there the surfactant inactivation starts and the alveoli start to collapse. So in the neonatal lungs we know that it starts more or less in the small airways, and then it transits the destruction is transmitted down to the alveoli level. We know much less about that in ARDS. But I believe both factors, small airway. Now Bouchard group in Toronto, Richard in Annecy, they have shown that if you open up the lungs, or if you are going to open up the lung in ARDS patients, about 30% of ARDS patients, nothing happens until you reach a certain pressure. There's no volume increase of the lung until you have a pressure of, say, 10, 15 centimeters above peak. Then the lungs, and that cannot be due to the alveoli, that must be due to small airway collapse. So small airway collapse is a phenomenon which is being re-estimated now on the basis of Bouchard's studies.
Do you want to
So going back to ventilation, sometimes when you ventilate ARDS patient, your plateau pressure is already reaching 30, and the patient starts air trapping, so you can't do anything with the RR. So is it okay to go with a pH of 7.25, like what I've been reading about ARDS?
7.25.
So sometimes like we call like lung protective strategy equal permissive hypercapnia, is that true?
I can't say more than there's no data. We have no data. Is it at times allowable to have a pH of 7.25? That's what your question.
Yes, because to be honest, I've done it before, so I
want to
know.
Sometimes we end up in situations where it's not possible to do much better. And then we should do that. Then we come to the questions, should you infuse some substance, some alkaline substance, and then you end up in a discussion which is far beyond my knowledge and ability to respond. Which substance should you inject? Bicarbonate, you know, is not the best one, but somebody else must discuss that. Of course, I mean, to compensate the respiratory acidosis is a possibility, and
which I know too little about.
Yeah. And Jay, time for a last question.
So I wanted to ask a different situation of the laparoscopic surgery in, say, a very obese patient, very steeply head down. we can't measure shear stress directly. What is it, the same recommendations in that situation? Are the same principles apply or different?
The same principles apply. And there is one issue about surfactant. These obese patients, they are often smokers. And smoking increases their liver capillary permeability dramatically. You can use this DTPA elimination test in order to study alveolar inflammation in other groups, but not in smokers, because they have already a perturbed surfactant and a large leakage between capillaries and alveoli. And I believe, there's no proof, that if patients are, if smokers do not smoke for a period of a few weeks, prognosis increase, and they say that this can be due to lesser carbon monoxide, hemoglobin, etc. But I believe it's because they recover very fast, 2, 3, 4 weeks after stopping smoking, the permeability situation is back to normal in smokers. And that is one reason why smokers should stop smoking. And if you have these obese patients and you see the lung collapsed and being reopened, if surfactant is, so if the surfactant situation is under control, this is not deleterious. It's only a combination of surfactant perturbation and reopening and closure, which is really, really dangerous. And that is probably the case for smokers. They are much in a much more dangerous situation in this case.
Right. Well, I'd like to thank Bjorn again, and thanks everyone for coming along. I do have a question of my own, but I'm sure Bjorn will not disappear straight away. if you want to stay along for other questions, you're very welcome. And otherwise, I'd like to thank Bjorn again for coming along.